We're going to talk about true friendship today and what kind of action that drives. And as I was preparing this week, I was actually reminded that today, 31 years ago, I lost my best friend, my childhood best friend, to a motorcycle accident. We were 18 years old. This had a profound effect on my life, as you'd expect that it would, anyone's life. A lot of childhood memories fade, some of them don't, and I have memories of my best friend that will never fade. True friendship is really important. If you were here a few weeks ago when the Joshes got baptized, that was so sweet. I feel like we got a little glimpse into what true friendship looks like. You know, authentic friendship, being transparent with each other, being vulnerable, sharing it in front of God and in front of his people. That was cool, man. I was jealous in all the best ways for that, and I hope that each of you has relationships like that. I hope each of you has friendships like that. But if you don't, I hope that you hear God's call on your life today to pursue them and to be that kind of friend for somebody else. True friendship is not measured by what you gain from the friendship, but by what you're willing to give up for the other person or for something greater than both of you, for what you're willing to put on the line. Greater love has no one than this, than that he laid down his life for his friends, a really wise man once said. The Bible has some incredible examples of true friendship, Ruth and Naomi, Jesus and Lazarus, Paul and Timothy, but probably none of them are more compelling than David and Jonathan. And we get to read the most compelling chapter of the David and Jonathan friendship this morning together. And I think this message on human friendships comes at an appropriate time for us, as if social media didn't do enough to kind of separate us from human-to-human, real human-to-human interaction. Now it's even worse because most of the people we interact with online are not even people. They're just bots. And now we have these LLMs we can talk to that just tell us sycophantically what we want to hear or what somebody, something wants us to hear. We need to invest more in human-to-human friendships. And God's Word is going to tell us some things about what that can look like today. So 1 Samuel 20, this stands at a hinge point in the books of 1 and 2 Samuel between Saul's decline and David's rise. And unlike a lot of the 1 and 2 Samuel, most of 1 and 2 Samuel, chapter 20 is not primarily about David or anybody else. It's primarily about Jonathan. So what Jonathan does in this chapter sort of carries the narrative forward. So we're going to follow Jonathan's actions and then learn some things from that, from our text this morning. Before we get into that, let's go to the Lord and pray. Gracious King, who is ever faithful to your promises, thank you for allowing us to be here. Thank you for redeeming us and adopting us. Thank you that we live in a free place where we can come here and worship you out loud, and what a joy it is to be here. Lord, thank you for allowing us to be here. Thank you for giving us your word, and I pray that you would speak to us by your Spirit through your word this morning. Help my words to not get in the way, but to help speak to our hearts this morning. We ask it in Christ's name. Amen. All right, read with me 1 Samuel chapter 20, starting in verse 1, first few verses. Then David fled from Naioth in Ramah and came and said to Jonathan, "What have I done? What's my iniquity and what is my sin before your father that he's seeking my life?" He said to him, "Far from it, you shall not die. Behold, my father does nothing, either great or small, without disclosing it to me. So why should my father hide this thing from me? It is not so." Yet David vowed again, saying, "Your father knows well that I have found favor in your sight, and he has said, 'Do not let Jonathan know this, or he'll be grieved.' But truly as the Lord lives and as your soul lives, there's hardly a step between me and death." Then Jonathan said to David, "Whatever you say, I will do for you." First thing I think we can take away from these first four verses is that there's a relationship remembered and loyalty that listens. There's a relationship remembered, loyalty that listens. So, who was in Ramah and why was David fleeing? You remember from last week? Back in chapter 19, David fled to Ramah from Saul, who was trying to kill him. And he went there to find Samuel. Also, David's wife, Saul's daughter, helped him escape. Saul pursued David to Naioth and Ramah. Why? Because he's trying to kill him. First, he did it with three separate groups of messengers, and then one by one, these messengers fell into some spiritual trance that allowed David to be protected from them finding him and killing him. And then finally, Saul comes himself to come get David and kill him. And then he finds himself in this humble situation before Samuel, and unable to carry out the task that he was intent on carrying out. So God's protecting David in this. So that whole opportunity provided an opportunity for David to get away. And he gets away, and where does he go? He flees to Jonathan. That's where we pick up here. What is he asking Jonathan? Well, he's asking Jonathan for help. He's pleading his innocence, right? Saying, what did I do to deserve this? Is this like legit that the king is trying to kill me? Jonathan seems genuinely shocked in verse 2. He basically says, no way. My dad tells me everything. I know everything that my dad does. And if he was trying to kill you, don't you think I would know? Now, Jonathan probably almost certainly doesn't know about the spear attacks. And he heard from his dad, if you remember a chapter ago, that his dad promised Jonathan, okay, I won't kill David, right? But Saul seems to be not in his right mind, bifurcating back and forth. So Jonathan doesn't really know what's going on at this point. David answers in a peculiar way, his friend. He says in verse 3, it says that he vowed again. What do you mean? What does that mean, vowing again? What's he referring to? Well, he's remembering the foundation of the relationship that was laid by Jonathan in chapter 18, where Jonathan swears on this covenant that he made with David. Then he gives a good reason for why Saul wouldn't tell his son his true intentions with David. He's like, look, he knows I've found favor in your eyes. He knows we're friends. He's not going to tell you that he wants to kill me. But David's trying to convince him and says, surely, hardly, there's hardly a step between me and death, in verse 3. In this case, for David, that was literal, right? Just a chapter ago with the whole spear thing, I mean, he just got missed by a spear. Literally, hardly a step between him and death. There's a little side application here, right in the beginning about that. It's that God communicates wisdom when he reminds us that there's hardly a step between us and death. He reminds each of us how close we are to death. I have a few stories, personal stories I can tell in here, but this one is fun and easier to tell. Some of you probably know it. It was about 12 years ago, I was with a buddy in West Virginia climbing, trad climbing, where you put your own protection in and you climb up the rocks. And I was about 900 feet off the ground. And we were up there too long because, you know, and we should have left because there's this huge storm coming, and we knew, but we hung out up there and we finished the climb. And so we're stuck in this thunderstorm now, and I'm standing on the edge of a 900-foot ledge, like literally one step. It's not a step I'm going to take, right? So I'm walking around the ledge, and I'm clipping in to the anchor. And as I clip into the anchor, 900 feet off the ground, a bolt of lightning hits, like, the rock right in between us and blows us off the rock, right? So that was, like, half a second away, right? God uses those things, I can assure you, in our lives as perspective-altering experiences, right? It's a good thing to remember. Any of us could die like that. It's a healthy perspective. The psalmist said in Psalm 90, teach us to number our days so that we may gain a heart of wisdom. Very wise. There's a whole sermon you could preach on this verse. It would be fun, but it's not the point of 1 Samuel 20, so I'm going to keep going. Let's get back to David here, needing to convince Jonathan that his dad, the king, was intent on killing him. And he was hiding it from Jonathan because of their relationship. They were friends. Notice how Jonathan responds to this. This is the point in our takeaway. He doesn't just hear David. He actively listens. That's the point of the dialogue back and forth. He gives his perspective. But then look how quickly he comes around to his friend. He doesn't keep on arguing or keep on convincing him. He says, I'm all in. I'm all in. He says, whatever you say, I will do for you. He just believes his friend and goes all in. Both of these guys, David and Jonathan, here are remembering and invoking a sacred covenant. And Jonathan is modeling what it looks like to be loyal to that covenant by listening to his friend and going all in for his friend. Now, as we move on, we're going to see that covenant relationship is anchored in something beyond the two in the relationship. And we get to see Jonathan being loyal to the covenant, surrendering. Relationship anchored, loyalty that surrenders. Pick up with me, and let's read verse 5. So David said to Jonathan, "Behold, tomorrow is the new moon, and I ought to sit down to eat with the king. But let me go, that I may hide myself in the field until the third evening. If your father misses me at all, then say, 'David earnestly asked leave of me to run to Bethlehem in his city, because it is the yearly sacrifice there for the whole family.' If he says it is good, your servant will be safe. But if he is very angry, know that he has decided on evil. Therefore, deal kindly with your servant, for you have brought your servant into a covenant of the Lord with you. But if there is iniquity in me, put me to death yourself, for why then should you bring me to your father?" Jonathan said, "Far be it from you, for if I should indeed learn that evil has been decided by my father to come upon you, then would I not tell you about it?" Then David said to Jonathan, "Who will tell me if your father answers you harshly?" Jonathan said to David, "Come and let us go out into the field." So both of them went out to the field. Then Jonathan said to David, "The Lord, the God of Israel, be witness. When I have sounded out my father about this time tomorrow or the third day, behold, if there is good feeling toward David, shall I not then send to you and make it known to you? If it please my father to do you harm, may the Lord do so to Jonathan and more also, if I do not make it known to you and send you away, that you may go safely. And may the Lord be with you, as he has been with my father. If I'm still alive, will you not show me the loving kindness of the Lord, that I may not die? You shall not cut off your loving kindness from my house forever, not even when the Lord cuts off every one of the enemies of David from the face of the earth." So Jonathan made a covenant with the house of David, saying, "May the Lord require it at the hands of David's enemies." Jonathan made David vow again because of his love for him, because he loved him as he loved his own life. Sort of a lot going on here, but it's centered around this new moon feast that's going to happen. David appeals to their covenant again and asks Jonathan to cover for him and use this opportunity to feel out what Saul's intentions are, to figure out if Saul's really angry and intent on killing David. Now, is David actually testing Saul's intentions here? I don't know. Probably, maybe he was just doing this so Jonathan could see what was going on, right? To see the truth of what was going on. Maybe both. Either way, Jonathan's response is what's important, I think, here for us this morning. It's anchored in something that transcends the relationship itself. It's anchored in a covenant, and he says, "I'll protect you, brother. I'll help you escape." David presses, "Who will tell me if I'm still in trouble with Saul?" Jonathan acts to reassure his friend. And in so doing, he surrenders to the sacred covenant that's already been established between he and David and Yahweh. Now, both of them are swearing on this covenant now. Jonathan explicitly invokes Yahweh several times in this passage using formal oath, formal covenant language that was common in the ancient Near East. And the purpose of it was to anchor their bond in something else. And that something else here is divine faithfulness over and above human loyalty alone. This ancient Near Eastern idea of covenant loyalty is not just mutual affection. It combines ideas of steadfast love and loyalty and kindness, but it's not just the combination of these things. Covenant oaths invoke God as a witness or a guarantor of a covenant. But the Old Testament goes even farther when Yahweh himself becomes personally active in these relationships, like his relationship with Israel. These relationships now carry a sense of obligation, not just to the other person, but to God, and to the other person for the sake of God. So when Jonathan surrenders to God's chosen king, it's not because of his love for David, not just because he was friends with David. He admits that God's kingdom is worth surrendering to, and that's what he's surrendering to, not to David. The whole relationship is anchored in this covenant with Yahweh. He surrenders to his obligations to God, primarily, and then to God's anointed by extension. He trusts in the promises made under the covenant because of the faithfulness of God, not because of his own affection for his friend. The Hebrew word translated loving kindness in this section of scripture, some of you might be familiar with, it's this word called hesed. Translated loving kindness, it's used four times in the verses that I just read. When first century Greeks translated the Old Testament into, from Hebrew into Greek, they translated this, a different word used for love, here in verse 17. It's not hesed, where Jonathan says, which Jonathan made David vow again, verse 17, because of his love for him, because he loved him as he loved his own life. There's love used three times. That word is translated as agape, and you're probably more familiar with the Greek word agape, unconditional love. This other word, hesed, can also be translated into the Greek word that means mercy. Right? Question for us at this point. How many of your relationships actually involve loyalty that transcends just the relationship? If you're married, I hope you have at least one in that category. You should. If you're a believer, if you're a Christian, you should have more than that. How many of our relationships are anchored in the more profound reality that transcends just the human-human interaction? In fact, it turns out to be the basis for the best kind of human-human interaction. These things transcend our own comfort, our own well-being. They even transcend the well-being of the other person in the relationship. If you're a member of Mountain Christian Church, then you have literally covenanted on paper and, more importantly, with your words to several things. Three categories of them. I have to quote them. You have covenanted to serve and support the ministry of this church with your time, talent, and treasures. You've covenanted to promote the maturity of this church by embracing your community responsibilities. You've covenanted to preserve the unity of this church and of this family in all relationships and in all interactions. These are significant relationships to engage in that aren't based on our own faithfulness to each other, right? They're based on his faithfulness to us. I heard a pastor a couple weeks ago say that God sanctifies individuals in the same way that he saves the world, and that's through his church gathered. If you have a relationship with God, then his plan to grow you happens in the context of a church community. We are to pursue relationships that go beyond ourselves and even just our relationships of camaraderie or mutual affection and our friends and this sort of thing. We do this entirely imperfectly. Several of you have probably noticed. But it's worth investing in. We're called to invest in it. We're empowered to invest in it. So let's invest in it. Okay, back to our text. What are we supposed to be surrendering to? And to whom are we supposed to be surrendering? Who is Jonathan surrendering to in the verses we just read? In this whole chapter, actually. He was surrendering ultimately to Yahweh, right? Not to David. What did he surrender? What did this covenant to protect God's anointed, what did this cost David? What did it cost Jonathan? Sorry, not David. What did it cost him? It cost him his whole inheritance, right? This guy's the crown prince. He's going to be king. It cost him his relationship with his father. Cost him his security, his ambitions, ultimately it cost him his life. A couple chapters later, he's dead. How about us? What do you think God might be calling you to? What is God calling me to surrender for the sake of kingdom relationships? Everything that Jonathan surrendered, right? My comfort, my security, even family approval in certain cases, if that's what it takes, my ambition, my life, anything. When properly anchored, true friendship is covenant loyalty. It's being willing to surrender everything. Jonathan goes a little further here, and we get to join him on this journey. And we're going to see in our next section here that we're going to see a covenant discerned, and we're going to see a loyalty that plans. Jonathan discerns some things here, and he plans some things. Let's read verse 18 and on together. Then Jonathan said to him, "Tomorrow is the new moon, and you will be missed because your seat will be empty. When you've stayed for 3 days, you shall go down quickly and come to the place where you hid yourself on that eventful day, and you shall remain by the stone Ezel. I will shoot 3 arrows to the side, as though I shot at a target, and behold, I will send the lad, saying, 'Go, find the arrows.' If I specifically say to the lad, 'Behold, the arrows are on this side of you,' get them. then come, for there is safety for you and no harm, as the Lord lives. But if I say to the youth, behold, the arrows are beyond you, go, for the Lord has sent you away. As for the agreement of which you and I have spoken, behold, the Lord is between you and me forever. David asked Jonathan, who's going to help me? Who's going to tell me? If Saul wants to kill me or not, Jonathan goes all in. He's discerning Yahweh's plan here, and he's judging it greater than his own prosperity. But Jonathan's commitment goes beyond just the passive surrender we saw a few verses ago. He plans. The actual verb for plan was in that section we just read. He plans out a detailed scheme with arrows and an unwitting servant boy, probably some sneaky counterintelligence OPSEC work, so that any spies looking on aren't going to see that anything is going on, right? He goes to great lengths. And the point of the great lengths is not that, you know, maybe there's a deception involved and we can justify that in that deception, which I think we can in this case, but that's not the point. The point is Jonathan's active commitment to using all of his resources, his brain, to discern the right thing to do and to take the initiative to prepare for action. He does that. Jonathan plans an operation here to signal his buddy safely so he can get away. Not just his buddy, right? God's anointed, future King David. So, question pops in my head at this point. When is surrender the most loyal thing to do, and when is taking the initiative the most loyal thing to do? Right? Plan, take the initiative, we can use those words interchangeably. How do we know when to surrender and when to act or plan to act? That's discernment. Knowing the difference between these two things is discernment. Knowing when there's no difference between these two things is discernment. What's the difference between surrendering to God and taking the initiative to obey God? Nothing. Surrendering is not always passive. Often it's not. Jonathan's discernment here in when to surrender to God's plan and lay down his own inheritance, his own ambitions, and submit to God's anointed king, and when to take the initiative to plan this little kingdom op that he planned to help David escape. When he discerned God's plan for David's house and Saul's house a couple chapters ago, Brian had us in last week, he made this covenant with David as God's anointed. And he took the initiative to attack this Philistine garrison back in chapter 18. In chapter 20, he's not just going along with David's idea for the signaling thing. He goes above and beyond. He plans a better op. And in this sense, he's being a really faithful friend. In October 1943, the Nazi occupation of Denmark issued orders to deport all Jewish citizens to concentration camps. Danes were told to submit, not to God, but to the power that be, to accept the political reality and just stay silent, to surrender in the face of obvious evil. On Sunday, October 3rd of that year, over 2,000 Lutheran churches in Denmark issued calls to action from the pulpit, and their pastors organized fishing parties that were a cover to smuggle Danish Jews across the water into Sweden to safety. Some of these fishermen were caught and executed, but 7,220 Jews escaped, according to records. Sometimes surrendering to God means taking the initiative and doing something. Most of us are naturally biased towards action or inaction. And if you're like me, you have the tendency to baptize your action or inaction after the fact, right? To make myself feel better, to look not so bad, right? Masking something like pride or laziness or whatever. Like being indecisive or dragging your feet about something that your wife wants you to do that you don't want to do. So maybe you pretend to convince yourself that you're waiting on God's timing or something like that. Or maybe rushing into a judgment or even harsh treatment of a neighbor that has a bumper sticker that really ticks you off, right? And you're just standing up for truth in your own mind, but really God's plan for you is probably to love that neighbor, especially if they would consider you an enemy, right? Enough about my sin this weekend. What about yours? How are you baptizing action or inaction? Jonathan doesn't surrender to his circumstances here. He surrenders to God. He has courage to take the initiative to protect God's future king, trusting God and his plan. This is godly discernment over and above laziness or cowardice or pride or any other motivation. And so now we have this operation that's planned, and now we get to see Jonathan execute that when it counts. So pick up with me in verse 24. And we're going to see here a relationship honored and loyalty that stands. Relationship honored, loyalty that stands. So David hid in the field, and when the new moon came, the king sat down to eat food. The king sat on his seat as usual, the seat by the wall, and then Jonathan rose up, and Abner sat down by Saul's side, but David's place was empty. Nevertheless, Saul did not speak anything that day, for he thought, "It is an accident. He's not clean. Surely he is not clean." It came about the next day, the second day of the new moon, that David's place was empty. So Saul said to Jonathan, his son, "Why has the son of Jesse not come to the meal, either yesterday or today?" Jonathan then answered Saul, "David earnestly asked leave of me to go to Bethlehem, for he said, 'Please let me go, since our family has a sacrifice in the city and my brother has commanded me to attend. And now, if I have found favor in your sight, please let me get away that I may see my brothers. For this reason, he's not come to the king's table.'" Then Saul's anger burned against Jonathan, and he said to him, "You son of a perverse, rebellious woman, do I not know that you are choosing the son of Jesse to your own shame and to the shame of your mother's nakedness? For as long as the son of Jesse lives on earth, neither you nor your kingdom will be established. Therefore now, send and bring him to me, for surely he must die." But Jonathan answered Saul, his father, and said to him, "Why should he be put to death? What has he done?" Then Saul hurled his spear at him to strike him down. So Jonathan knew that his father had decided to put David to death. Then Jonathan arose from the table in fierce anger and did not eat food on the second day of the new moon, for he was grieved over David because his father had dishonored him. Now, as a king's commander and a member of his family, actually, as David's was, missing one of these royal feasts would have been an insult to the king. That's the point. This was a monthly new moon feast. You can read about these in Numbers 28, if you want to jot that down, read about them later. Apparently, I didn't know this, they span more than one day, and they involve peace offerings with communal feasting on sacrificial meat, so the participants needed to be ceremonially clean. Right? This is Saul's assumption about why David's not there the first day. So no David, Saul just blows it off, thinking, well, he's unclean. Surely he's unclean, almost like he's trying to convince himself. There's lots of reasons he could be unclean. You can go read about them in Leviticus. But this would have been a common reason to recuse yourself from one of these ceremonial meals. So day number two, still no David. Now Saul knows what's up, and he asks Jonathan where David is, and Jonathan gives the canned response, the fabricated excuse, which sets Saul off. He, like, loses his mind again. I spent a little bit of time trying to translate Saul's words in verse 30 into contemporary language. And I can't come up with anything that I can say from the pulpit. You can use your imagination. Tom Constable's commentary, somebody I use a lot, his Bible study notes, had in the notes, it was kind of shocking actually, you should go read them, three different like contemporary translations of this, none of which you can use in a sermon. So the point is he was swearing. He like lost his mind and was cursing and saying bad things about his son and his wife. And so Jonathan has to absorb his father's wrath as a result of his loyalty to the covenant. There's kind of a cool theological rabbit trail we could follow here. I'm not going to, because I don't think that's the point right here in our text this morning. But it's pretty neat. So Jonathan stands by his covenant with David and with God, and it costs him something. It costs him a lot. Cost him his kingdom, it cost him his inheritance, it cost him his relationship with his father. "As long as the son of Jesse lives on earth, neither you nor your kingdom will be established," Saul says. Saul probably thinks he's doing Jonathan a favor by killing David to secure the kingdom for him. In light of all this, Jonathan still takes a stand to defend David. The cost is obvious to him now, but Jonathan stays true to his covenant with David and with God. He stays true to what's true, even at potential cost of everything, including his life. It says that Jonathan then skips dinner, and he's grieved. He's not grieved over everything he's giving up, like we just talked about. He's not grieved over the fact that his dad is freaking out in unstable bursts of anger, which would have made sense. It says that he's grieved over David because his father had dishonored him. When even the dishonor of his best friend was insulted, Jonathan took a stand. He defends David's dignity and in so doing honors God. Gary Chapman might be familiar to you. He's the love language guy, the guy who wrote that book. He has a story in there. Here's a story. It's about Gary and his wife, Carolyn, as they were going through a really difficult time of clashing personalities in their marriage. During a weekend trip away from his wife, Gary was sitting with a group of married men. The conversation quickly devolved into a wife-bashing session. The men began complaining about their wives' flaws, making disparaging jokes, and looking for Gary to join in. Gary felt the cultural pressure to fit in by exposing his wife's flaws to the group. Instead, he made a conscious, silent decision to honor the covenant. He interrupted the conversation. He didn't lecture them. Instead, he simply chose to speak highly of his wife's strengths, completely shifting the atmosphere of the room. He later noted that honoring his wife when she wasn't there to defend herself in this way was the turning point that saved his marriage. The next time you or I are tempted by circumstance to acquiesce or to go along with something that dishonors a sacred relationship, how about rather we take a stand for the dignity of other people and for the honor of God? These kinds of opportunities will surely come for you and for me. And when they do, I hope that we have eyes to see what an incredible opportunity it is to honor God in something simple, even if it costs us something, even if it's super uncomfortable. Okay, so far we have seen Jonathan listening, we've seen him surrendering, we've seen him planning, we've seen him standing up for what needs honoring, even when it's costly. And finally, we get to see a covenant kept, loyalty that endures. A covenant kept, loyalty that endures. Read with me the rest of our passage, starting in verse 35. Now it came about in the morning that Jonathan went out to the field for the appointment with David, and a little lad was with him. He said to his lad, "Run, find now the arrows which I'm about to shoot." And as the lad was running, he shot an arrow past him. Just pause for a second. Don't do this with your kids. I mean, really. It's amazing that I never saw a commentator point this out. Like, this is abnormal behavior. Apparently it wasn't. Very unsafe. Okay, verse 37. When the lad reached the place of the arrow which Jonathan had shot, Jonathan called after the lad and said, "Is not the arrow beyond you?" And Jonathan called after the lad, "Hurry, be quick, do not stay." And Jonathan's lad picked up the arrow and came to his master. But the lad was not aware of anything. Only Jonathan and David knew about the matter. Then Jonathan gave his weapons to his lad and said to him, "Go, bring them to the city." When the lad was gone, David rose from the south side and fell on his face to the ground, and he bowed 3 times. And they kissed each other and wept. But David wept the more. Jonathan said to David, "Go in safety, inasmuch as we have sworn to each other in the name of the Lord, saying, 'The Lord will be between me and you, and between my descendants and your descendants forever.'" Then he arose and departed, while Jonathan went into the city. Jonathan is being faithful here. He keeps his promise, and he runs this signaling operation that he planned earlier, using the unwitting servant boy. And then he goes even farther. He sends the servant boy back to the city with his weapons so that he can say goodbye to David in person, right, in private. Maybe this is an aside. Why send the boy with the weapons? That's kind of an interesting thing. Was it indicative of Jonathan's trust for David? Well, surely, and we already know that at this point, that he trusts David. Was he ditching his royal garb to be more secret so he would be less noticeable? Maybe. It also could have just been prudent planning, right? Returning the servant boy to the city without his master for no reason would have drawn suspicion, right? So he gives him a task to do, sets him off to do it. So he has time to go see David. That's probably what was going on. We've already seen Jonathan as a good tactician. Jonathan's loyalty endures all the hardship we've talked about. He runs this signaling operation, and now he makes this cool opportunity to say goodbye to David. We can't miss how deferent David is to Jonathan. Look in verse 41. there. David fell on his face to the ground, and he bowed 3 times. This is a gesture of maximum reverence, like Abraham falling on his face before the Lord in Genesis 17, like Jacob bowing to Esau in Genesis 33, like Joseph's brothers bowing to him before they knew he was their brother when they thought he was just this ruler in Egypt. Now Jonathan and David share a beautiful moment, and then they renew their covenant again, this time with a sort of shift in language from an oath formula to more of a blessing formula. The Lord will be between me and you and between my descendants and your descendants forever. David goes one way in exile. Jonathan goes another way to the city. That's all it says. What a simple and mundane way to end this chapter. But endurance can be mundane, right? It can seem mundane. Endurance for Jonathan was extremely risky. He was courageous not just because he stood up for David at the feast with his dad, but now that his dad's figuring out in no uncertain terms what's going on, this king of the land prone to fits of murderous rage, most recently at Jonathan himself, the whole spear thing, after giving up everything and siding with the house of David over the house of Saul, his own house, Jonathan made himself an enemy to his dad. And so going back to this kingdom that he's an enemy to would have been tremendously dangerous. But he did it. I think it's worth noting that Jonathan didn't take license to save himself from the danger, even after he picked sides. I mean, you read this thing and you're like, why didn't you just go with David, right? I mean, why go back? We'll get there in a second. Why does David cry more than Jonathan in this story? David was a fugitive, an exile on the run. And he's crying more, it says, for his friend. Why? Jonathan was probably in more danger than David at this point, right? Going back to that situation. David and Jonathan meet only one more time in chapter 23 before Jonathan dies in a battle alongside his dad, never seeing David reign as king. Loyal friendship, anchored in covenant faithfulness, costs something. Jonathan knew what he was risking. He knew what he was giving up, yet he endured, whatever the cost. Question, what has faithfulness cost me? What has faithfulness cost you? If your answer is nothing or not much, are you sure you're being faithful? I don't want to be the kind of Christian who's only in it for my own comfort or any other earthly benefit. I want to be more like Jonathan. And I hope you do too. So back to the question of why didn't Jonathan go back? Why didn't he go back? Well, even in this, I think he was being faithful. First, it was dishonorable to abandon your father. You have a duty to respect your parents. And especially in this culture. And even though Saul was angered by Jonathan picking sides against him, Jonathan hadn't publicly dishonored his dad in this way. And politically, the crown prince had certain obligations. So he had obligations that he couldn't just ignore. Plus, he could probably protect David better from his place of influence and power if he held it. So even in his leaving and parting ways and returning home, Jonathan is being faithful. Faithfulness in one area, his friendship with David, isn't justification for faithlessness in another area, like his family obligations. We shouldn't shirk our responsibilities to family, for example, because we're trying to be faithful in some other area. This hit me yesterday, ironically, in sermon prep, as I was home alone with my son, with my door shut, right? Like, working on this, and he's out there. So if I don't have a good ending to this sermon, that's why. I was convicted. Do you want to be more faithful? Well, figure out where you anchor your loyalty. And if it's not in the God of the universe who created you and loves you and created you to be in a relationship with other people, then re-anchor. Pick up your anchor and move it. Jonathan is anchored in this text, and it makes him a true friend, a real friend who listens, who surrenders, who plans and takes the initiative, who stands up for what needs honoring, even when it costs him a lot, and who endures, keeping his covenant actually all the way to his early death alongside his dad, 11 chapters from now. You may know from this story of David, it's a very common story, that David also honors the covenant. About 10 years later, after wars and power consolidations and bloodshed, after David is king, David remembered the house of Saul by seeking out and finding Jonathan's son, Mephibosheth. You can read about it in 2 Samuel chapter 9. All throughout these last few chapters in 1 Samuel, I've been reminded of all the ways I want to be more like Jonathan, but I've also been reminded of all the ways I'm probably more like Saul most of the time. Proud, selfish, hasty, reactionary, insecure. There's a longer list, but I'm going to stop there. But the character in the story that I can most identify with comes later on in the story, in Mephibosheth. Here's someone who's lame and broken and needy and totally at the mercy of the king, who has every right to destroy him, but instead blesses him, instead makes him like a son. David offers Mephibosheth mercy in place of wrath. David pointed out back in verse 3 that there's only one step between him and death, right? And we took away from that, yeah, that's a wise thing. It's good to remember that there's only one step between us and death, but it's also true that there's only one step between you and life. That is true too. God offers everyone mercy in place of wrath, the wrath that we deserve. In an upheaval of the way that ancient Near Eastern covenants normally worked, God, the king, suffers in place of his subjects in the person of Christ, the chosen one from David's line, to pay the debt that we owe to God, a debt that we are incapable of paying ourselves. The cost of your reconciliation and mine was paid already 2,000 years ago. God defeated death so that we don't have to suffer the consequences of it. So I would implore you to surrender while you can, if you never have, because you don't know when the opportunity will be gone for you. Life or death are just a step away for any of us. Friends, Christ is the only anchor worth holding on to. Maybe you have anchored your life in Christ in the past, but you're drifting for whatever reason, and your relationships are suffering as a result with other people. Well, you can re-up that covenant and re-anchor. God, as an anchor, never moves, right? Our salvation doesn't depend on us. But take a look in 1 Samuel and look at how many times Jonathan and David reaffirm their covenant. Every time they talk, basically, they're re-upping the covenant and reaffirming it. It's not too late to do this with God. He doesn't change, but we drift all over the place. You can re-anchor. Maybe you've been hurt by a relationship that wasn't properly anchored in Christ. Maybe it's your fault. Maybe it's not. I'd encourage you to never let someone else's failure nullify the faithfulness of God. Let God be true and every human being a liar, Paul said in Romans 3, in this context. He has much greater things for you and for me. That one step between any of us and life, two quotes from the New Testament. Paul says that God made Christ, who knew no sin, to be sin on our behalf so that we might become the righteousness of God in him. And he also said, if you confess with your mouth Jesus is Lord and believe in your heart that God raised him from the dead, you will be saved. This is the one step. This is how easy it is. And we heard from Brian this morning that if we confess him, he will confess us in front of the Father. He has greater things for you. Somebody needs you to be a Jonathan in their lives. I promise you that's the case. That's how God built us. If you don't know who that is, if you don't have somebody in mind, well, get yourself anchored and then figure it out. They're out there, I promise you. Would you stand with me and let's pray.